This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Hello and welcome. Welcome to VOA Africa. Thank you for joining us. I'm Yehiyas Wahib in Washington. Here's what's coming up on Africa News Tonight.
You know, the Moroccans know that they have not seen an earthquake of this size for some time, but they also have experienced devastating earthquakes in the past. For example, in 1960, there was an earthquake that caused about 12 to 15,000 fatalities.
That was William Yack, research geophysicist at the United States Geological Survey, on the September 8th earthquake in Morocco. Details coming up. Also, tons of aid arriving in Libya to help survivors of mass flooding. And the African Union peacekeeping force in Somalia has begun gradually withdrawing. These stories and more on African News Tonight. But first, our top story.
The United States seeks a more secure, more prosperous, more equitable world for all people, because we know our future is bound to yours. Let me repeat that again. We know our future is bound to yours. And no nation can meet the challenges of today alone.
That was U.S. President Joe Biden speaking today at the United Nations General Assembly in New York. Biden's speech was aimed at convincing world leaders that his vision of American leadership and multilateral approach to foreign policy will help solve the world's most pressing problems. He said global cooperation is key to addressing common problems such as health crisis and climate change.
Nowhere is that more critical than accelerating the climate crisis, than the accelerating climate crisis. We see it everywhere. Record-breaking heat waves in the United States and China, wildfires ravaging North America and Southern Europe, a fifth year of drought in the Horn of Africa, tragic, tragic flooding in Libya. My heart goes out to the people of Libya. That's killed thousands of people. Together, these snapshots tell an urgent story of what awaits us if we fail to reduce our dependence on fossil fuels and begin to climate-proof the world.
He again denounced Russia's invasion of Ukraine as a violation of a core principle of the UN Charter. Leaders from at least 145 countries are slated to attend the annual General Assembly meeting this week in New York, with a few notable exceptions. France, the United Kingdom, China, and Russia will be represented by their senior officials. This means that the United States is the only permanent member of the UN Security Council whose top leader will be present. Amid concerns that their sustainable development goals are not on track, world leaders at the UN General Assembly in New York have adopted a political declaration that brings hope to developing countries. Veronica Balderas Iglesias has the details from the United Nations.
On a rainy day in New York City, a somber reminder at the United Nations General Assembly of how world leaders are behind schedule in meeting the 17 Sustainable Development Goals they adopted in 2015 and hoped to achieve by 2030. Dennis Francis, President of the United Nations General Assembly.
Despite commitments to eradicate poverty and to reduce hunger being at the core of this agenda, alarmingly, 1.2 billion people were still living in multidimensional poverty as of 2022. It is estimated that approximately 8% of global population, or 680 million people, will still be facing hunger in 2030.
Young leaders also raised concerns about the lack of progress toward the Sustainable Development Goals, or SDGs, demanding action to combat climate change and concrete solutions to empower their generation. This is how Mayeda Adel, a young leader for the SDGs, put it.
68 million young people are looking for jobs. All over the world, millions of young people are unable to access social protection coverage. Mental health problems like depression and anxiety are a serious concern for young people.
World leaders did manage to adopt on Monday a political declaration that brings a ray of hope to struggling economies, said United Nations Secretary General Antonio Guterres.
This includes clear support for an SDG stimulus of at least $500 billion a year, as well as an effective debt relief mechanism that supports payment suspensions, longer lending terms, and lower rates.
Guterres said countries can help get the SDGs back on track by paying attention to six targeted areas, including relieving hunger, ensuring gender equality, and improving education.
Our proposed Global Digital Compact will also help countries build safe digital systems that provide internet access for all, including students in hard-to-reach communities.
Guterres highlighted another initiative that aims to create 400 million new jobs, especially in the green, care, and digital sectors. He also emphasized that countries must act now to rescue the SDGs. Verónica Valderas Iglesias, VOA News, the United Nations.
The World Health Organization says 29 tons of aid have arrived in the eastern Libyan city of Benghazi, offering a lifeline to thousands despite dwindling hopes of finding more survivors from deadly flash floods 9 days ago. About 4,000 bodies have been recovered and 9,000 more people are missing. Tons of aid from Egypt, Turkey, and Italy have also arrived in the east, along with a field hospital from France. Wolfgang Poshtai, former Austrian military attaché in Libya, discussed with VOA senior analyst Mohamed El-Shenawi domestic, regional, and international aid to Libya.
There is a tremendous amount of help from Western Libya, especially and remarkably from Misrata, but also from several other cities like Sintan. Even some militias like the 4-4-4 has sent relief goods and rescue workers. Actually, the 4-4-4 is cooperating on the ground with their arch enemies from the Tariq bin Ziyad Brigade, which is absolutely great. The biggest international supporters right now are Italy, Turkey, and especially Egypt. Italy has sent two amphibious helicopter carriers, huge ships with lots of goods and experts on board. Turkey, which has sent, was one of the first ones on the ground in Derna, has sent, among other, two huge modern amphibious ships. And the Egyptian armed forces are carrying out support and relief operations with several thousand troops and civilian aid workers in almost the entire disaster area. This includes engineers, field hospitals, emergency housing, heavy helicopters, helicopter carrier Anwar el-Sadat, and other heavy equipment. So that's really remarkable. The Egyptians are providing by far the largest part of the foreign support.
Wolfram Latcher, Libya specialist at the German Institute of International and Security Affairs, said a puzzle of dysfunction, incompetence, carelessness, neglect, and corruption is slowly emerging behind the catastrophe in Derna. What's your take on that?
There is an increasing number of statements like this, especially from one side blaming the other. But this is not that easy. There are four elements: geography, the maintenance of the dams, the control of terrain, and the availability of funds. Derna is located at the narrow exit of the Wadi Derna, which is with about 70 kilometers length, the by far longest wadi in the Green Mountains, with a drainage basin of almost 600 square kilometers. The capacity of the two dams is up to 25 million cubic meters. The last larger maintenance took place in 2002. In 2007, there was a contract for a Turkish company, but due to the revolution, the works could not be finalized. Actually, the construction sites were looted. There was some funding provided in 2012 and 2013, but at this time, Derna was already under the rule of various jihadi groups, and no company had an idea to get there. The Shura Council of Derna Mujahideen conducted a guerrilla campaign against Haftar's LNA until the city was finally besieged and taken by the LNA in 2018-2019. On Saturday, September 9 last week, there was a two-day curfew imposed by the LNA and by the Ministry of the Interior of the Eastern Government for Benghazi and several other coastal cities because of the approach of Daniel. Several units of the LNA and of the Red Crescent were put on alert. Some particularly exposed houses were evacuated. Just the last hours before the dams in Derna bursted, the police and soldiers of the LNA tried to urge the population of Derna to flee, but many refused because they believed that this is exaggerated. These statements were actually confirmed by some survivors. and then Daniel arrived. Within 24 hours, the two reservoirs received more than 115 million cubic meters of water, an amount more than four times the combined bearing capacity of the two dams. The result was something like a deadly high-pressure pump pumping water into the city.
That was Wolfgang Porchtai, former Austrian military attaché in Libya, speaking with VOA's Mohammed El-Shenawi. An earthquake ripped through Morocco's Atlas Mountains on September 9th, killing around 3,000 people and leaving many more homeless as traditional clay-built houses collapsed. William Yack is a research geophysicist at the United States Geological Survey. My first question to him was, if such a quake with a magnitude of 6.8 on the Richter scale was a common occurrence for the area?
Yeah, that's a great question. So typically, you know, where we see the most earthquakes around the globe is at plate tectonic boundaries. So that's where two tectonic plates are interacting with each other. We don't have a plate boundary directly in the vicinity of this earthquake. You know, it is an area where there is a pretty low rate of seismicity. So it's not something that we observe very often. You know, the Moroccans know that they have not seen an earthquake of this size for some time. But they also have experienced devastating earthquakes in the past. For example, in 1960, there was an earthquake that caused about 12 to 15,000 fatalities.
Was there any way of monitoring the Moroccan earthquake from where you are, from here at in the United States?
Yes, I'm at the USGS National Earthquake Information Center, and our mission is to observe global seismicity. So we use seismometers throughout the globe to monitor that seismicity. And an earthquake of this size, a magnitude 6.8, is easily observed at seismometers all the way on the other side of the globe. So yeah, we monitor and we measure the size of the earthquake using seismometers across the globe, but we can observe it. You know, I'm in Golden, Colorado, and we can observe that earthquake even in Golden, Colorado, because it's so large.
So talk to us now about the science behind these earthquakes.
Yeah, so earthquakes are a natural phenomenon, and we, at the National Earthquake Information Center, we record earthquakes globally every day. So it's a very common occurrence. Earthquakes are really destructive when they're close to people. So that's when we see these damaging sorts of earthquakes. But generally, we see earthquakes across the globe in very remote regions where no one ever feels them. So they're a natural occurrence, and they really occur when a fault slips. And those fault slips, because as we know from plate tectonics, the tectonic plates are moving around, and that causes stress to accumulate within the Earth's crust. And as that accumulates, eventually it needs to release. And when that fault slips and releases that stress, it results in an earthquake.
And then we have the aftershocks.
Yeah, so aftershocks, after an earthquake slips, it creates perturbations or changes in the stress around the fault that slipped, and that can cause an increase of seismicity near that earthquake. So it's very common to see aftershocks. Actually, in this sequence, we've seen very few aftershocks. Right now, we have four recorded at our threshold at the NEIC after this main shock. But generally, you see more and more smaller and smaller earthquakes, so small felt earthquakes would be expected. But yeah, aftershocks are a normal occurrence after a significant earthquake.
So Will, in the case of Morocco, the population lives in structures that are highly vulnerable to earthquake shaking. It would be nice to warn people. So where do we stand in the research of predicting earthquakes?
Yeah, unfortunately, we're not able to predict earthquakes. There's no way to indicate when an earthquake is going to happen. So really what we try to do is create good earthquake catalogs so that we know the rate of seismicity and the expected size of seismicity in specific regions so we can estimate the seismic hazard. But there's no way to actually predict exactly when an earthquake is going to occur. So, I mean, the recommendation is that if you live in an area where that's prone to earthquakes, just to be prepared for an earthquake.
And lastly, Will, what about these earthquake lights?
Yeah, so earthquake lights, I mean, it's something that people have observed, and it's really unclear as to what the phenomenon is. There have been cases where people have seen earthquake lights, and what it's ended up being is infrastructure failing, like transformers exploding, and that has caused lights that people have observed. So we don't really have a great link to what might cause these lights. scientifically and, you know, the actual observation, but it is true that people have observed earthquake lights in the past.
That was William Yak, a research geophysicist at the United States Geological Survey. He spoke with me from the U.S. state of Colorado. You're listening to African News Tonight on The Voice of America. The African Union peacekeeping force in Somalia has begun gradually withdrawing from the country in anticipation of Somali forces taking over security duties by the end of 2024. AU forces have been deployed since 2007 to help the Somali government fight the Al-Shabaab militant group, but the fight is far from over, as Mohamed Sheikh Noor reports from Mogadishu.
After 16 years protecting government installations and land in South and Central Somalia, the African Union peacekeeping force, known since 2022 as the African Union Transition Mission in Somalia, or ATMIS, has started to withdraw from the country as national forces are expected to fill the role by the end of 2024. In June, 2,000 ATMIS soldiers were withdrawn, transferring 6 forward operating bases, or FOBs, to Somalia's national forces. In the next phase now underway, another 3,000 are expected to leave Somalia by the end of September. Lieutenant General Sam Okeding, the ATMIS force commander, says the drawdown has been gradual to prevent security vacuum.
It is not one move. If it was a one move, then we would say, no, things are going to be bad. But this one is orderly, from step by step.
National forces will be ready to replace ATMIS when two conditions are met, says Abdirahman Mohamed Touriere, a former director of Somalia National Intelligence and Security Agency. He says the first condition is that Somali forces must be provided with the same level of assets and equipment as ATMIS. He says the second condition is that United Nations arms embargo imposed in Somalia must be lifted. Although the Somali forces are considered ill-equipped, Ibrahim Hassan Haji, the Ministry of Defense's Director of Communications, has confidence in their ability. He says, as you might well know, Somali forces have occupied the forward operating bases vacated by ATMIS. He says, we believe that they are able to handle the control of these bases. Hassan Sheikh, a political analyst and former advisor to Somali president, would like to see a more autonomous Somalia after ATMIS fully withdraws.
Middle Africa, waxay in mudacaawinayeen dalkeeda dadka Soomaaliyeed.
Sheikh says the African Union has long provided assistance to the country and its people. When they withdraw from Somalia, he says, the Somali people will need to take responsibility for their own affairs, form the national government and unite with it to ensure its protection with Somali power and resources, rather than foreign funds. The African Union peacekeeping mission has been in Somalia since 2007, supporting the Somali government in combating the Al-Shabaab insurgencies. In spite of this, Al-Shabaab's war is not over as the group continues to hold towns, villages and remote areas. Mohamed Sheikh Noor, VOA News, Mogadishu, Somalia.
South Sudanese people are fleeing Sudan's war for their home country, and the United Nations and analysts say the move could trigger intercommunal violence. From Renk, South Sudan, Henry Wilkins reports.
At the river port in Renk, South Sudan, returnees fleeing fighting in Sudan prepare to board boats to transport them south on the White Nile to the city of Malakal. Having fled into communal violence in South Sudan years ago, Sarah Reef, along with her children, has been forced back to Upper Nile State because of Sudan's conflict, which started in April. Reef talked to VOA about starting over in her hometown. She says she doesn't know what she will do to earn a living, so she will have to do whatever she can. She doesn't have any resources to start up a business either, but nonetheless won't be going back to Sudan. Since the start of the war, more than 200,000 people have fled Sudan for South Sudan, mostly through Renk. The South Sudanese government is doing all it can to move them away from the border and prevent a build-up in Renk of people in need of humanitarian assistance. They are being relocated on these cramped boats to areas they left years ago, and in many cases have only tenuous connections to. Despite this, it's better than staying in Sudan, says returnee Rebecca Deng. She says the fighting in Sudan is intense, a huge problem. People go without food for 5 days. People are killed in the street and some are unable to leave their homes because of constant gunfire, day and night. Analysts say the influx of returnees is likely to cause major problems for South Sudan's transition to democracy, with the country's first elections planned for next year. Peter Biar Ajak is a South Sudan expert at Harvard University.
For many years, we had many South Sudanese population that had fled to the north who are now returning back, and they're returning back to a country that is not ready to receive them. So we have a lot of humanitarian crisis, and it raises a question. Should we be thinking about elections at a time of such severe humanitarian catastrophe? That situation could also affect the long-term stability and security of South Sudan.
He added that politicians should not use the conflict as an excuse to delay elections, however. Salem Tadese Demise of the South Africa-based Institute for Security Studies said that South Sudan returnees could clash with members of other ethnic groups in the areas they relocate to.
And the humanitarian responses so far are not really structured in a way that really addresses the needs of the returnees. Therefore, this situation might lead to communal violence. And this communal violence has been cited as one of the major challenges of the implementation of the peace process itself.
Violence among the returnees' different ethnic groups has already broken out in both Renk and Malakal. Henry Wilkins, VOA News, Renk, South Sudan.
Botswana has put restrictions on the movement of cloven-hoofed animals in the northeast of the country after an incursion of buffalo from Zimbabwe put cattle at risk of contracting possible foot and mouth disease. Mokondisi Dube reports from Habrone.
Several hundred buffalo have been sighted in areas near the Zimbabwean border. Zimbabwe National Parks says more than 500 of the animals recently crossed into Botswana from the Hwange National Park in search of water and food. Botswana authorities fear the buffalo could spread foot and mouth disease to the country's cows, sheep and goats. Botswana's Director of Veterinary Services, Kifense Mutsekwa, says steps have been taken to stop the possible spread of disease. He says, we have imposed movement restrictions in the affected areas. Cattle must not be moved from the affected zones until we determine if there is an outbreak. Veterinarians are testing cattle for the disease and farmers will be informed within 30 days of the outcome. Last year, following the outbreak of the disease, the government was forced to cull more than 10,000 cattle to stop its spread. Botswana's acting agriculture minister, Karabo Hare, says there is also a need to safeguard humans from the buffalo. He says, we have to do everything to fight the spread of the disease, but not only the disease, but also to protect lives as buffaloes are dangerous animals. Wildlife management expert Eric Ferrien says buffalo are able to enter Botswana because of another large beast, elephants.
And now we see more and more animals coming in, and the department is really battling and struggling to maintain the fences because the elephants keep on breaking in.
Local veterinarian and farmer Mbatswi Mazituma says there is a need to take quick steps to avoid the spread of the ailment.
The implications are that in these times of drought and in this time of lack of water resources, the buffaloes will be hungry and thin. There is a risk that they may be shedding more virus, and the government is doing all it can to round them up humanely, offer them water, and also the ones that are debilitated to dispose of them humanely, whilst also concurrently doing the necessary measures to make sure that the possibility of foot and mouth disease does not spread.
Buffalo are often linked with the sporadic outbreaks of foot and mouth in Botswana, affecting beef exports. Botswana exports about 10,000 tons of beef annually to the European Union, where the country enjoys duty and quota-free access. Mqondisi Dube, VOA News, Gaborone, Botswana.
And with that, we wrap up this edition of African News Tonight. I'm Yehiyas Wuhib in Washington. on behalf of our producer, Mokbilia Baro, and our engineer, Adrius Regas, thanks for choosing The Voice of America.